first speaker is Abhay Ashlekar, who needs no introduction. So I'm very happy to be able to introduce him.
Oh, no. It's not my time, right?
Excuse me. Abhay Ashlekar is the Eberle Professor of Physics and Director of the Institute of Gravitational Physics and Geometry at Penn State University. He did his PhD at University of Chicago on the asymptotic structure of the gravitational field. He then held a gravitational chair professorship at University of Paris 6, after which he moved to Syracuse University. In 1986, he found the new variables for quantum gravity and subsequently co-founded the loop quantum gravity approach, which many of you work on. He then moved to Penn State University. He has made very significant contributions also to classical GR and QFT on curved spacetime. Of particular importance are his work on asymptotic symmetries and the BMS group, more recently isolated horizons. There's a very important paper that he and Anne Magnan wrote on using algebraic ideas in quantum field theory and curved spacetime. Abhay?
Thank you.
Yes.
Great. So, thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to be in Perimeter, and especially for this Emil-Noether workshop. I'm going to stand here just because it's too close to the screen there. I hope it is okay. If you would like me to go up front, I will. So the topic that I've chosen for this general conference is basically implications of quantum nature of space-time for the Big Bang and black holes. And this is in tune with the theme of the conference. And also because Bianca told us that most people, there's a diversity of audience, so most people are not familiar with any one approach. So I'll try to also make my talk quite general. So, preamble. The first thing is that if we want to probe quantum nature of geometry, then it seems to me that the Big Bang and black hole singularity of general relativity offer a really compelling context, because that's where classical space-time continuum completely breaks down. And I will summarize what we know about this from loop quantum gravity. Now, the basic premise of loop quantum gravity is really that geometry is a physical entity. This is what we learned from Einstein in the classical domain, and loop quantum gravity takes it to the quantum domain. So it should have also, just like this table looks like a continuum, but as atomic structure, similarly, the space-time geometry should have some quantum or atomic structure. And loop quantum gravity provides a specific one, which is based on a detailed and rigorous mathematical framework that was developed in the 1990s. But then there are questions, right? I mean, the questions are, so in these most spectacular places where classical theory has problems, what happens in loop quantum gravity? What are the implications of this quantum geometry for the Big Bang and black holes? And when the continuum of general relativity breaks and the classical physics come to a stop. So in particular, one wants to know, what is the nature of the quantum extension of classical space-time? How do we describe it? What are its physical properties? And can the consequences of singularity resolution be tested? So this is the issues that we want to talk about. And right away, let me just tell you two main messages that I want to convey. The first is that quantum geometry underlying loop quantum gravity is subtle in the following sense. Detailed calculations show that its effects are negligible, not only at the horizon of a solar mass black hole, where one thinks of being large curvature. We heard this beautiful talk about gravitational waves yesterday, the strong field regime and so on. But the quantum effects are completely negligible there in loop quantum gravity, but also at the onset of inflation. Most people don't realize it, that at the onset of inflation, the space-time curvature is some 10 to the 55 times higher than that at the horizon of a solar mass black hole. But these effects really decay very quickly, and classicality is achieved very quickly. And one of the reasons is that the spectra of geometric operators that I'll talk about a little bit are not sort of equally spaced. It's not, for example, for the area operator, the spectrum is not, you know, one Planck length square, two Planck length squared, etc. But rather, it really crowds as the area increases. And therefore, this crowding is exponential. And therefore, the continuum limit is reached very quickly. And the second lesson I want to talk about is that there are several different levels of quantum geometry manifestations depending on which observables or probes one actually uses, and these in turn are chosen by the physical problem at hand. The first level is a fundamental level, the Planck scale itself, and that in loop quantum gravity is described by spin networks and associated geometric operators. Then there's a coarse-grained level where one is interested only in a few degrees of freedom, a few macroscopic observables, for example, the average matter field or the anisotropies or homogeneous part of the spatial curvature of gravity and so on. And these can be described by a wave function then, which depends only on a few degrees of freedom. For example, in quantum cosmology, it could be the scale factor, anisotropies, matter fields, and so on, which are generally treated to be homogeneous, although there are also cases like Gaudi models that have been looked at in loop quantum gravity, where we do not have spatial homogeneity. And then we also have, inside the black hole, where the wave function state would depend on the radius and the geometry and the scalar field that may be actually the sourcing the black hole. And the third level is really, so the first level fundamental, then coarse-grained level, here is still is quantum. And the third level is that the geometry seen by quantum fields representing perturbations propagating on quantum spacetimes. So this is a probe that the quantum spacetimes are propagating quantum geometry. What do they see? Do they see all the details or do they see only a few aspects of quantum geometry? And in loop quantum gravity, it is represented by what is called a certain Drest effective metric, which is actually a smooth tensor field whose coefficients involve Planck's constant. So this captures some information in these wave functions, but not all the information in the wave functions. And this is sort of interesting to me because I think there's a potential for making contact with the asymptotic safety program. Then I think this is the kind of thing that Astrid is very interested in, and she's giving the next talk. So we might hear a little bit more about making contacts between various programs. So the organization of the talk is the following. In the first part, I'm going to talk about the cosmological application, the Big Bang, in the second, which is in blue up here. And in the second part, I'm going to talk about black holes and the information loss. And this work is by, the work that I'll report is by many researchers up here. The blue part is for the quantum cosmology. The black part is for black holes up here. And there is related work by many others. There literally are several, probably 10,000 papers on all of these things. And obviously, I cannot cover everything. I'll just give you overall picture, a glimpse of the sort of takeaway messages. So let me begin with the first part up here, namely the very early universe. But let me just tell you a little bit about quantum geometry before that.
Quick question. Yeah. Is that three-level analysis, three is like with TS, or is that the number three?
Say it again. I didn't say
three. The previous slide?
Yeah, sure.
Sorry, the previous slide.
Yeah, three. Three?
No, no.
Oh, sorry, I'm going forward and not backward. Yeah.
Okay, the three level, is that three the number three or is that three?
Number three.
Number three.
Okay. Okay. In loop quantum gravity, the geometrical operators, so let me just have one lightning summary. There are people from loop quantum gravity in the audience. To them, I apologize. This is all very boring. But on the other hand, there are a few things that they may not know about that will come towards the end of this part and also in the next part, which is on black holes. In loop quantum gravity, observables are self-adjoint operators, geometric observables. Like I said, the area of the surface of this table, you give me a physical surface, like for the surface of this table, and that they are geometric operators, like, for example, the hydrogen atom, Hamiltonian, angular momentum, and so on, and they have discrete eigenvalues. Of particular interest is really the area operator. So again, you give me this physical object, its area depends on the metric in this room, so it's an observable, and now the question is, what happens in quantum theory? There's a self-adjoint operator associated with that, a hat up here, and it has discrete eigenvalues. And the smallest eigenvalue, smallest non-zero eigenvalue, is called the area gap, just like the energy gap idea in ordinary quantum mechanics. And the classical curvature, the reason why this plays an important role is the following. Recall that classical curvature can be obtained by taking a loop and taking the holonomy of the connection around this loop up here and subtracting one from it, dividing by the area, and then taking the limit as the area goes to zero. In loop quantum gravity, the curvature operator is defined by a similar formula, but here you've got an operator, and here identity, of course, and then you divide by the area of the loop, but now the area goes to the minimum area that we got, this area gap, and therefore the area gap plays a key role in the LQG dynamics. It sort of sets a certain scale, which then dictates other macroscopic phenomena, the scales at which other macroscopic phenomena occur. So this area gap features, for example, in the maximum density that can actually is allowed in loop quantum gravity. So for the early universe, one truncates the theory to a few degrees of freedom. We're talking about the early universe. And it works, for example, with the wave function of scale factor. But here I'm working with kind of a volume. So I just fix a particular box, take its volume to be V. And as the universe expands, the volume, the metric changes, and the volume increases of this box. So volume just goes like a cube. In the limit, in the final analysis, when you're, it's like an infrared cutoff, if you like. And final analysis, when you take the limit of the limit to infinity, for the final analysis, in the final results, after the analysis is completed, one takes the limit as the volume goes, or the box goes to infinity. But so this is a dynamical variable which goes like a cube. If one wishes, deparameterize the theory, and this is in sort of in harmony with the talk of quantum reference frames that we heard yesterday, in which it's a relational dynamics. One regards one of the fields as being providing an internal clock with respect to which other fields, such as the matter density or the curvature, anisotropies, and so on, evolve. Unlike in general relativity, in the standard Wheeler de Vries theory, both these theories, the matter density is not bounded from below. You can have configurations with arbitrary matter density interacting with gravity. Here, in the cosmological context, in fact, the matter density operator rho hat has an absolute upper bound. And you can see again here, the area gap that I talked about, this is a microscopic parameter which governs this macroscopic parameter up here. Area gap is in the denominator. So if you take the limit that the area gap goes to zero, as in the Wheeler de Vries theory, then you get infinity, There is no the upper bound is just infinite, but in loop quantum gravity, that is finite. And its numerical value is about half a Planck density. Similarly, the maximum value of curvature in the cosmological models is about 62 Planck length square. In diverse models, it seems to be that there is the upper bound seems to be more or less absolute because it is governed by the area gap in some ways. And the radius of curvature seems to be about 0.1 Planck length. That seems to be the maximum upper limit for the radius of curvature. For the radius of curvature, that seems to be the lower limit that you can have. Take it badly. For the curvature is upper limit, and therefore the upper limit for the curvature is so and so, and that translates to some curvature goes like 1 upon r squared, radius of curvature, not curvature, radius of curvature goes like 1 upon r squared, and we got that radius of curvature at the maximum value of curvature. The wave function undergoes a bounce once these upper bounds are reached, and the Big Bang is replaced by a big bounce. So here is a plot of one cosmological models. What one is plotting is a scalar field. Here is a volume up here. You start at some late time, like today's universe, which is very sharply peaked Gaussian state. You evolve it back in time. In classical theory, this Gaussian is actually peaked at the classical trajectory, which would go to zero volume, but in loop quantum cosmology, it bounces when these upper bounds are reached, and then it comes back up here. And therefore, this is what is happening up here to the wave functions. And so this is the second level I talked about, where the wave functions are only know about a few degrees of freedom. Okay, so the key modification of Einstein dynamics is well captured in the effective equations. And for example, the effective Friedmann equation is the following. The standard Friedmann equation in general relativity sorry. The standard Friedmann equation, general relativity, is just a red equation here. A dot by A whole squared is 8 pi g rho over 3. It is now corrected by a term which is rho upon rho sup. And rho sup is what I told you about before. And there is a separation of scales then. When the energy density is negligible compared to rho sup, then this term is neglected and we just get the first term. But when the energy density becomes equal to rho sup, this term just vanishes, A dot vanishes, and that is where you got the bounce occurring. Yeah.
In the previous diagram that you had, you have wave functions that are peaked at the classical geometry. And if I, in ordinary quantum mechanics, if I'm starting off with a peaked wave function, the evolution is going to diffuse it, and it won't remain peaked. So what is it in the dynamics here?
So you can construct examples of dynamics in classical mechanics, which will take me too far away to explain, in which that does not happen. I mean, usually you're used to free particles or something. But here, here because of the gravity interaction with gravity,
it remains coherent.
It really remains coherent. The spread is completely negligible. People have done an S matrix theory. This is work by Kaminsky and Pawlowski from minus infinity to infinity, starting with a wave function like that, and see and put a bound about how much dispersion there is in the from minus infinity to infinity, and this is very small. I can give you the disk. Yeah, so it is a striking difference in this particular case, but this is not something that is peculiar to loop quantum gravity. It also happens in Wheeler-DeWitt theory. If, of course, the Wheeler-DeWitt theory, the singularity is not resolved, but if you look at what happens to the future, then the same thing happens. And the mechanism is not that there is unphysical, you put unphysical matter which violates energy condition or new boundary conditions, but really the quantum geometry creates a brand new repulsive force. In this equation, actually, is a simplified version. What changes at a fundamental level is the left-hand side of Einstein's equation. And by some algebraic manipulation, I put the terms, the additional terms here on the right-hand side and converted them to matter. But really what changes is the left-hand side of Einstein's equation. And quantum geometry, therefore, creates a brand new repulsive force in the Planck regime, overwhelming the classical attraction. And this is understood in the Hamiltonian, path integral, and consistent histories frameworks. There are many generalizations to various models, cosmological models, including, as I mentioned, the Gaudi model, which is not spatially homogeneous, is the simplest inhomogeneous model that we have. And the general lesson is that every time a curvature scalar enters the Planck regime, the quantum geometry repulsive force dilutes it, preventing a blow-up. Over the last 2 years, this is an important point for various people who sort of feel that this is all mini superspace, and therefore few degrees of freedom is not important. But over the last 2 years, there have been significant advances to arrive at the loop quantum cosmology effective equations. This is the work of Dapour, Ligner, Pawlowski, and particularly Emmanuel Alessi and other people. So they can start with full loop quantum gravity, uses Thiemann Hamiltonian from loop quantum gravity, and then arrive at an effective equation like that. What happens in the pre-Big Bang branch changes, and these are still ongoing work, there are some limitations of that work, but the singularity is resolved and the qualitative picture that we get up here is really quite robust. And this is perhaps not very surprising, and this is what I want to sort of mention to you, because remember that we can have full quantum electrodynamics, and one may want to have just the hydrogen atom. So what did Dirac do? Dirac said, well, let us just use a spherical symmetry. Well, all photons disappear. There are no spherical symmetric photons. So you would say, well, this is drastic simplification. System with infinite number of degrees of freedom is reduced to a finite number of degrees of freedom. And yet the hydrogen atom gives excellent approximations to the full quantum electrodynamics until you come to a lamp shift. And so the hope is that the same thing is true here. There will be corrections, but gross features might be captured. And that has been a hope in loop quantum cosmology in all approaches for a long time. Okay, now I want to talk about second part, which has to do with the cosmological perturbations. And the inflationary paradigm has been remarkably successful because we have Friedman, Lemaître, Robertson, Walker background. And the main thing that we have learned in the last 20 years or so is that these perturbations have to be treated quantum mechanically as quantum fields. So what we have is really quantum fields propagating on the classical Friedman space-time. But now what we have is not a classical Friedman space-time, but something else. But from the point of inflation then, the program is incomplete because the singularity, Big Bang singularity still persists. And then inflation is just as quantum fields propagated on classical background. Now what we need is a quantum Friedman, Lemaître, Robertson geometry, which replaces the classical background. Quantum field theory on this quantum space-time up here. And finally, initial conditions in the Planck era. Now, I already mentioned one and two, that the Big Bang singularity is resolved, and we have a wave function psi of psi naught, I'm calling it naught because it is a wave function of the background, which replaces the classical Friedman metric that is used in inflation. And so, what I now want to discuss is this issue three. I don't have, unfortunately, time to discuss issue four up here. And so, in loop quantum cosmology, there are successful completions of the standard inflationary paradigm, or 11 or 12 orders of magnitude in density and curvature, all the way to Planck scale. So at the onset of inflation, by that I mean when the pivot mode exits the Hubble horizon during inflation, from that time on, if you go backward in time, the bounce occurs backward in time. At the bounce, the energy density is Planck scale, and at the onset of inflation, it is about 10 to the minus 11. 12 times the Planck density. And that is why loop quantum gravity considerations are actually negligible. So the question is, what happens early on? So first, this looked completely hopelessly difficult. First, it looks completely difficult because it's already quantum field theory in curved space-time is hard enough. What about quantum field theory in a classical geometry? But there is an unforeseen simplification. Supposing we assume that perturbations are perturbations, so therefore they can be regarded as test fields, their back reaction can be neglected, and we find solutions to our quantum equations, which are background and the perturbation, and then idea is to find these solutions and check if, in fact, this approximation of neglecting background is realized in this solution. If in fact such solutions exist, then the Planck regime is dealt with squarely, provided the perturbation energy density is much less than the background energy density, and then from the bounds till we arrive at the classical regime, we would have a good theory of cosmological perturbations. So as I said, this seems rather difficult to begin with, but there is an unforeseen simplification, namely the dynamics of the two tensor modes and the scalar mode of cosmological perturbations on a quantum geometry is mathematically equivalent to that of dynamics of these fields on a smooth space-time metric with a dressed effective C number metric. The coefficients of this metric are determined by certain expectation values in this psi naught. So you start with this psi naught, but extract only certain information from this psi naught. This information, for example, the scale factor that you're using up here is really coming from here. So we use this information from the wave function. If you like, the wave function has all kinds of fluctuations, and we're extracting only certain information, not only the averages, but certain fluctuations, to construct a background, a classical metric up here. And then the dynamics of the perturbations on this classical, smooth metric is completely, is equivalent to that of the perturbations propagating on this quantum background. And the analogy that I like to give is, there are many analogies we can give, but one of them is really, for example, I can take a liquid and I can look at light propagating in it. I mean, of course, at the molecular level, there is a lot of interaction between photons and molecules and so on. Yet, if in fact the light beam is not so strong as to actually boil this water, then what is happening can be described just by a couple of parameters, which is refractive index and by fringes, which you can calculate from the microscopic structure, but the light doesn't see the rest of the microscopic structure. And that is what is happening. And because of this, a lot of mathematical machinery can be taken over from quantum field theory in curved space-time to quantum geometry. Okay, so this is the this is what is happening. And now, the question is about, that's why there's been a lot of work. Now, one of the questions that I'd like to ask is the following. This is kind of a conceptual and philosophical question. Could we ever see what the true quantum state, say psi naught, is near the big bounce, right, in the deep Planck regime? So that's a question we want to ask. Well, it depends on the observational tools. The observational tools that we have today are just the cosmological perturbations. And as we just saw, the cosmological perturbations don't see the full wave function, but they see only the dressed effective metric, a few moments of that wave function. And furthermore, what we measure in practice is not the full, only sort of the 2-point and 3-point correlations. This is the non-Gaussianity, and those are the power spectra and the spectral indices. And thus, in passage from psi naught to the power spectrum, there are two levels of filters. First, multiple psi naughts can give you the same effective metric. And finally, several effective metrics might produce a spectrum which has the same first and two moments up here, the first and two correlation functions. And the answer, so the question is, can we have very different psi naught that lead to the same observables, same power spectra and the spectral index? And what we found was very surprising, that the answer is yes, and the states can be very different. You can take a very sharply peaked Gaussian state, or you can take a Gaussian state in which the dispersion is the relative dispersion, the dispersion is larger than the value of the field, of the volume, if you like, up there. So we can calculate this, we can take such states, or we can take a non-Gaussian state, which are also very wild up here, similar to some of the questions. And then you can evolve, and we see that, in fact, what you find is that the evolution actually produces for you the power spectra and the spectral index, which are identical. So unless we come with qualitatively new probes in the early universe, we would never know that. We'll only get a limited amount of information about the quantum geometry. And this is something that is sort of useful for this audience who is interested in philosophical, conceptual, et cetera, points. But it is just a fact of nature that with the tools that we can imagine today, we really will not be able to probe these details of this quantum geometry. Now, there's a third part, which had to do with the interplay between observations and theory. I will leave it in the discussion session because of the time that went on. Sorry, Sumati, your introduction was way too long. So I'll just talk about this. So this is the organization of the first part. Now I want to change gears, and I want to talk about black holes. So the summary of the first part is that the quantum geometry effects of loop quantum gravity do actually resolve the Big Bang singularity. And furthermore, you get some quantum geometry with which you can do analysis of cosmological perturbations and actually arrive at predictions. And the part I skipped was that from loop quantum cosmology, we do have predictions for the TT, temperature-temperature power spectrum. There is agreement with the observation and standard inflation. But for the electric polarization power spectrum, our predictions at large angular scales are different from that of standard inflation. And the Planck team just released their likelihood code just a few months ago, and we are now quantifying how much that difference is. Basically, for those who are interested, this gives you an optical depth which will be higher than the last value that Planck gave. In Planck data, if you look at the value of the optical depth that they first published, which was for small angular scale, L bigger than 50, and then look at the optical depth they get from smaller angular scales up here between them, the relative discrepancy is 36%. So you don't have a value of optical depth for the whole spectrum, whereas in loop quantum gravity, you do have that, and that is being worked out. And this will be good for future tests, cosmological tests, because different kinds of measurements will be done for optical depth. Okay, I summarized already what happened.
I started the clock only after I finished.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about the black hole part up here. And the work that I'm going to report has been done by here. But as I said, there's a work by many other people, and I'll be happy to discuss it throughout this week. Okay, So black hole and information loss. So change of gears completely. So let me just start from scratch to put everybody at ease. So this is a standard picture. It's a stellar collapse. It collapses, forms a horizon. There's a singularity. Light cones are up, tipping up here. They start tipping. And then at the horizon, all the future rays fall into the black hole. So information is actually, the better picture of causal diagram is, as you know, the Penrose diagram. This is a star. And we find here that there is the event horizon that is formed. The event horizon up here is formed. And the light rays from the behind the event horizon all fall into the singularity. You never reach infinity from here. So when a collapsing star creates an event horizon, and the boundary, this is the boundary of the trapped region up here, from which light cannot escape, however long you wait. And therefore, the local of event horizon requires. This important point that is not emphasized enough, this was emphasized first by Gerosch and Horowitz, that the notion of event horizon requires that sky plus should be complete. Because if I just say that I got a piece of sky, and that is all of my sky, I just stop sky somewhere, you know, halfway between, then even in Minkowski space, there will be a black hole, because part of that sky will not be all of space-time. So sky has to be complete. This is like a trivial point, but we are going to see it's important. So now Hawking effect and back reaction. So again, I'll not worry about this picture. I'll worry about this picture. But people often evoke this picture to say that the black hole loses mass, and therefore the horizon area shrinks. So the curvature, if you like, as you go to the right of a Penrose diagram, is decreasing. And finally, the mass actually disappears. So the black hole disappears. And then we got poof. And then finally, we got subsurface up here. So information was actually lost. But remember, even if the black hole has disappeared, there is still a singularity here. In the Penrose diagram that Hawking drew this Penrose diagram in the original paper to depict what happens in the case of evaporating black holes. In this diagram, again, there's a star which is collapsing. The singularity is formed, but the black hole is evaporating. And therefore, at the end, there is no mass left up here. And therefore, in this region, if you like, we got flat space. And this is what is happening. Now, in this picture, it is clear that if this were actually what is happening, then information is lost going from this Cauchy surface to this Cauchy surface, or from sky minus to sky plus. Because if I give myself initial data here, I can predict what is happening here. But if you give me initial data here, I cannot predict what is happening here. Part of the state, so to say, has fallen into the singularity. So that is a general most relativist thing, that if the singularity persists, then there will be loss of information in the asymptotic region. But some people like to use this picture and insist on unitarity. If, in fact, you want unitarity in this picture, then, so to say, the information has to come out. The part of the information which fell across the horizon has to somehow manage to come out here, because this part is essentially flat up here. So you have to have the state appears to be a mixed state here, a thermal state here, but it should be purified already in this semi-classical region. And then one has to, so some string theorists believe that this should happen, and that then they invoke novel ideas. First, there was a quantum Xerox machine, that the information which is falling in here is somehow copied with information here, and then that goes out. Then the idea was of firewalls, and now people talk about fast scramblers, etc. But firewalls, for example, would imply a surprising failure of semi-classical physics around the horizons of large black holes and so on. And so this seems to be uncomfortable. But as we just saw, in cosmological context, singularity is resolved. That opens the door that, in fact, the space-time is much larger, and things can actually propagate across here. And that is a viewpoint that is taken in loop quantum gravity. So, but to talk about that viewpoint, let me just give you a prelude. Just two points, conceptually very important points, but that are somehow implicit or not at all seen. The first is that in the Hawking's derivation, as we just saw, we had a star, and the star collapsed up here. And this was made of some material, but the field that is specified as sky minus is a completely different field. And we're specifying the vacuum state here, and then the field gets excited, more propagate to sky plus, sky minus, and so on. So the system is not really a complete system. Star is a classical star, and then you got a quantum field. But if you want to talk about unitarity, analyze issues of unitarity and information loss, we need really strictly a closed system. So for example, what we need to have is that something which is falling in from here, and that something is included as part of the quantum analysis. So for example, I may have a scalar field, a Gaussian scalar field which is falling in, and the quantum level, I would say that I got a covariant state of a Gaussian, covariant state of a quantum field which is falling in up here. And then I got this covariant state that is falling in, but there are quantum fluctuations of the covariant states. They are the same as quantum fluctuations of the vacuum. And therefore, these quantum fluctuations are going to grow and going to give rise to the Hawking effect up here. So there's only one field which forms a black hole and through which the black hole also evaporates. So we need a closed system. And the second thing is that in the semi-classical region, there is no event horizon. This is what I emphasized before. This was done explicitly by a paper in which I did the analytical part, and Franz Pretorius and his student, Fethi, did the numerical part. And we saw explicitly that what we do is we send in a, in this case, it was a thin shell, so thin shell of scalar field, which is sent in here. To begin with, it was a thick scale, thick shell, that also we have, but I did not want to go into too many details here. So that goes in, and then what happens is that at some stage, what happens is that there is a, the marginally trapped surfaces, and these marginally trapped surfaces, they constitute what is called as dynamical horizon, and this dynamical horizon is space-like in the time the black hole is actually forming up here. The dynamical horizon is space-like, and when it starts evaporating, it becomes time-like, and things can leak out of this dynamical horizon. And then we looked at the semi-classical part, and we see show explicitly that sky is not complete here. And therefore, this really is not an event horizon. And in fact, we showed that this part of the space-time is completely regular. There is no firewall, there is no singularity up here, there is no shock. And in fact, you can therefore be able to continue space-time, but for that, we need a quantum theory of gravity. There was another analysis with Madhavan Varadarajan, which showed that under some assumptions, you can make qualitative statements about what this extension should be and how unitarity could be recovered. Okay.
Sorry, this is a 1 plus 1D calculation?
Yeah, so this calculation that I showed is 1 plus 1D calculation.
So it's CGHS. The space-time is 1 plus 1 dimensional? Or?
Space-time is 1 plus 1. So it's, you can think of it as 4-dimensional space-time for which I've done spherical symmetric reduction. But that 4-dimensional space-time will not be the Schwarzschild space-time. It would be this.
But you don't really expect the fireball in 1 plus 1 dimension.
Right. So the statement, that's a very good point. But on the other hand, Hawking and Stewart wrote a paper a long time ago saying that, in fact, there should be a thunderbolt, which is today's firewall, in this model. They did write a paper there. Okay, so the statement up here is the following, that nonetheless, if I look at just the semi-classical region, even then there are quantum geometry effects that are important. So let me just walk you through this, because this I think is conceptually really important. So here is a picture. What we have is some scalar field which is falling in, making a black hole. Here is a dynamical horizon which is space-like in this region, becomes time-like, and the Hawking pairs. The pairs of bores are actually being created. One is going out, one is falling into the dynamical horizon. As a result, the area of the dynamical horizon shrinks. Once the area enters the Planck regime, we just cut the space-time, and this will be the semi-classical regime. So this is, if you like, is the last ray in the semi-classical regime. This is the ray that comes when the dynamical horizon is first formed and turns over and becomes time-like. Up to here, there is no Hawking radiation, almost no Hawking radiation. And then after that, however, the Hawking radiation picks up and grows in this particular region. Now I'm talking about 4-dimensional picture, and this is what we expect up here. But there is a puzzle. The puzzle is the following. So I think this is the part that you should sort of take away. Namely, supposing I form a solar mass black hole, and supposing I wait until it has a lunar mass. Lunar mass is about 1×10⁻⁷ times solar mass. So during this time, in fact, this puzzle, this takes about 10⁶ years. During this time, about 10⁵ modes are emitted to infinity, and they're approximately thermal up here, and they're correlated with modes which are fallen inside up here. Now, by the end of the day here, the black hole has shrunk to a 0.1 millimeter size. So how could I fit in so many modes in this 0.1 inside the black hole with this 0.1 millimeter size object? which are correlated with this 10^10^75 mode. So even if I take the largest wavelength that I can naively think about, the energy would be some 10^22 times the lunar mass. And therefore, this is just not, we don't think that this is really possible. And that is, in fact, a key reason why people like to think that somehow already in the semi-classical region, purification should occur. That this correlation should be lost, correlation should be recovered already in this semi-classical region. But the surprising resolution of this is the following. What you can do is you can look at the geometry here. Yeah.
I'm really sorry. I'm just struggling a bit. Apologies if I missed it, but did you say what you meant by a dynamical horizon?
Yeah. Thank you. No, I did not say it. Thank you. So this is a notion that was developed in order to talk about dynamics of black holes. So black holes which are not static, which are not stationary, but which are changing in time. So what it is a three-dimensional surface which is foliated, which is sliced, by two spheres which are marginally trapped. So on one side, you will have trapped region, and on the other side, you've got normal region up here. But it's not on the event horizon, because this dynamical horizon can appear and disappear. In the classical relativity, dynamical horizon then becomes tangential to the event horizon. Once the incoming matter falls, stops, then it becomes tangential to the event horizon. This dynamical horizon is very strongly used in all the numerical simulations. When you see the numerical simulation of black hole collisions, when you see the horizon, they're talking about the dynamic. Okay, thank you. So what forms and evaporates is this dynamical horizon. And I told you now the puzzle. The puzzle is that even in a semi-classical regime, when the solar mass becomes a lunar mass, there is a tension up here. And the surprising resolution is the following, that if you calculate the metric in this region, because of the incoming negative energy flux in this region, which we know from the stress area tensor what its form should be, then in this metric, we can look at continuation of some surface. So previously, I had a space-like surface like that. I had a space-like surface like that. I can continue it inside, but inside this dynamical horizon that I just had. So I continue. I continue it in the dynamical horizon region up here. I continue it. So I take a space-like surface like this sigma. I take another space-like surface and I continue it here. I want next diagram which shows this explicitly. Now, how do you continue it? Well, you continue it in some invariant manner. So for example, you can take Kretschmann scalar, and that equal to constant is an invariant surface up here. And what happens is the following. The surface starts out kind of like a reasonable surface, like in Schwarzschild space-time. But as time passes on, this surface starts developing a neck. And this neck becomes longer and longer. And you will say, yeah, but how much long? Well, we've got a lot of time, right? We've got 10^63 years up here for this process. In this 10^63 years, this neck becomes 10^55 light years. So in outside, it looks like a 0.1 millimeter two sphere, 0.1 millimeters two sphere. And then you go inside, and then it becomes extremely long up here. And therefore, modes in this region, which have fallen in, they become extremely long wavelength modes. So by just back up the envelope calculation, you can see that one can easily accommodate so many modes. Which have the right energy within the energy balance. So there is no problem at all. So now to complete the picture, what one has to do...
Sorry, this picture, does it depend on the way you slice?
Yes, so I'm providing you... I'm providing it a particular slicing, invariant slicing. Should not be...
There could be a singularity.
There are three slicings people are considered. I'll just give you one. And all of them, this long necks turn up. So if you like, I'm going to give you a quantum field theory evolution consistently using one slicing. That should tell me what is happening up there. I mean, that may not be it. It may not be, it's consistent evolution. Okay. Now, this is what is happening, but the picture actually stopped. Sorry about this, but the picture actually stopped at the semi-classical region. What happens beyond up here? And more recent work has shown that in fact the singularity is also resolved in the black hole picture. So this work was done using just the classical space-time, not the dynamical space-time. Dynamical space-time is now being looked at in great detail. But what happens is the following. In the classical space-time, we got singularity happening here. If you use this loop quantum gravity equations in this picture, which is a little bit more complicated than in the cosmological picture, then what happens is that because the quantum geometry effects are completely negligible in the past, but they become very, 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 very important up here, and they actually resolve the singularity. Now, how do they resolve the singularity? What happens to the singularity? The singularity is replaced by what we call a transition surface. The past of it, one only has trapped surfaces, so the expansion of all null rays actually converging up here. Here is anti-trapped. So it's like a white hole-like surface up here. The expansion here is actually both expansions are outgoing up here. And on this surface, both expansions vanish. This very interesting geometric surface, and it cannot occur in classical general relativity if the null energy condition is satisfied. So this is what happens in the dynamics in loop quantum gravity for this classical space-time. And therefore, and the effective metric is regular everywhere. For macroscopic black holes, Einstein's equations are satisfied to an excellent accuracy till very near tau. That's why this tau is shown in a small way up here, in a small region up here. But then the quantum gravity effects kick in, and they become very important. Okay. So I was going to tell you more about what is the final picture, which is what people are working on, which has to do with how exactly. The final picture is that I got the surface up here, anything you like up here. Here it's a very long neck surface. And then this surface evolved, the neck becomes longer and longer. But now we've got a perfectly nice geometry, and therefore these boards can come out. But they would come out in a very long length way, very long length boards, and therefore the evaporation time would be quite long. And then there is a current work that is going on here. So let me just summarize with this. The Big Bang and black holes offer ideal arenas to probe the structure of quantum space-time. And both have been analyzed to a great extent in loop quantum gravity. The analysis has led to some striking features of quantum geometry. First of all, the quantum geometry of loop quantum gravity creates an effective repulsive force once the curvature scalars enter the Planck regime. The singularity theorems of classical general relativity are evaded because Einstein's equations don't hold. Now you can take the corrections to Einstein equation, put them on the right hand side, and make the left hand side just the Einstein tensor. Then there is an effective stress energy tensor which violates energy conditions, but this is not put in by hand. This is really the quantum geometry being interpreted as an effective stress energy tensor. Interestingly, these modifications are completely negligible until one reaches a Planck scale. They are 1 part in 10 to the minus 8 at the horizon of just a million Planck length black hole. Really negligible, even up to a million Planck length black hole. And 1 part in 10 to the minus 12 at the onset of inflation. But then they rise very quickly and overcome the tremendous classical attraction, diluting the curvature scalars and resolving the classical singularity. And physical observables, such as curvature scalars and matter density, are absolute upper bounds near the Big Bang and black hole space-time, and that arises systematically from the area gap. And finally, the singularity resolution profoundly alters the conceptual paradigm through concrete effects, but we really do not know how to observe this quantum geometry directly unless we obtain qualitatively new probes. And as I told you, that there are 3 levels. We can have fundamental level of spin networks quantum geometries in quantum electrodynamics, that is like working with full QED. Then we can have only a few degrees of freedom that was used in the analysis that I presented here in cosmology. And the analogy there with the hydrogen atom. And finally, when probed by quantum fields, cosmological perturbations, or Hawking modes, or power spectrum, et cetera, then we only see an addressed effective metric. And analogy here is really, as I said, light propagating in a liquid or electrons in a laser beam. And we have seen all these manifestations of quantum geometry and emphasizing one or the other, depending on the physics of the problem. Thank you.
scenario for evaporation of black holes, then why this holographic principle? Is that correct?
What is the holographic principle?
The number of degrees of freedom.
Right. So the statement is that, exactly right. So that was another long. So the statement is that is true for a young black hole, it's not true for an old black hole. And then there's a long discussion about exactly what happened. You're right.
Thanks.
Any other questions?
Everything clear?
So one thing, about singularity resolution, one of the singularities that was found in black holes is the mass inflation singularity. Will this deal with that? I mean, that's exponential growth in the curvature.
So those
been addressed in this program?
No. And the reason for that is because really we have been looking at space-like singularities. We have not looked at this. Now, what is likely to happen is really that generic singularities will be null because of the inner horizon will become unstable, and then and so one should really look at the null singularities, and also one should look at kind of revisit our the mass inflation problem, not with these horizons, but really a null singularity in the future or something. When loop quantum gravity has not done very much at all in terms of null singularities. Wolfgang, who is here, has been looking at null formulations and so on, but not much work in that case.
Thank you.